So, yeah, Dharma Sharlin spoke to us a couple of days ago about the warrior, the aspect of a warrior stepping up into a situation to speak out, to care for other people, to speak out for what we value. And I'm going to speak today, carrying on from there, about the inner world of a warrior, the kind of the challenges, the inner battles a warrior has to face. And I'll start with an image. If you could just imagine a vast body of water, maybe a great lake or an ocean, just a vast body of water. And our consciousness, our being is like this. Our mind is like this. Our consciousness is like this. And a lot of the time we just dwell on the surface. We dwell very much just on the surface with all the froth and the foam in our minds, the kind of surface chatter, the kind of everyday surface chatter of things, the kind of stories we live in. We dwell very much on the surface, just with a very narrow part of our being, our consciousness. But there's great depths to our mind, to our being and our consciousness. And if we want to truly be a warrior in the spiritual life, well, we need to harness those depths. We need to harness the energies from the depths of our being. And when you do start to meditate, when you do set out on the path, the spiritual path, well, you start to inhabit more of these depths of the mind. And you might have some kind of interesting encounters, some very strong encounters, perhaps in meditation. And Buddhism has a very rich mythology, which gives some texture, some idea, some kind of form to what these encounters might take. And one of the myths which in Buddhism, which I'm very keen about, is the myth of the Naga or the dragon. So Nagas are said to be serpent-like beings, kind of mythical creatures that dwell in the depths of these large bodies of waters. Very kind of strong, powerful coils, shiny scales, very similar to the Western cousin of the Naga, the dragon. And like the dragon, the Naga is a protector of treasure. Both the Nagas and the dragons are protectors of treasure. The Nagas keep the treasure out of the way of people who aren't ready for them in the murky depths of the ocean. So there's lots of legends about Nagas in Buddhist mythology, in Buddhist suttas and sutras. One striking one is just after the Buddha's enlightenment. So the Buddha's just freshly awakened, sitting underneath the Bodhi tree at Bodh Gaya. And out of season, a great rainstorm comes, a great cloud darkens the sky for 7 days, and there's 7 nights of rainfall and darkness all over the land. And out of the water appeared a Naga serpent and wrapped itself around the Buddha 7 times, and with its head just covered and protected the Buddha to make sure he wasn't harmed during this storm. He wasn't wet, he wasn't harmed during this storm. And when the storm subsided, the Naga uncoiled itself, transformed into a prince and bowed to the Buddha. So, yeah, Nagas can sometimes be kind of troublesome. They can, in some of the legends, they can get in the way of spiritual progress. They can be kind of troublesome, difficult beings. But when the Buddha's involved, they often are protecting the Buddha. The Nagas become protectors of the Buddha. Yeah, so you might have guessed, I do like Nagas. I like Nagas and dragons, you might have guessed. And that's partly one of the reasons why my preceptor gave me the name Bodhinaga, because he knew I had this strong connection with the myth of Nagas. But I wasn't always interested in dragons and Nagas. To begin with, actually, for much of my life, I wasn't even slightly interested in dragons or Nagas. But this all changed about 5 or 6 years ago. And I was meditating in the Sheffield Buddha Centre in our small shrine room downstairs, the Red Shrine Room, we call it. Probably doing one of the morning meditations, I think. And I was in the mindfulness of breathing, and it was a bit of a dull mindfulness of breathing that morning. Not much was going on. But out of the corner of my eye, all of a sudden I kind of glimpsed in my mind's eye, my imagination, my meditation, something shiny. It was a box of treasure, a treasure chest. I glimpsed in the kind of my imagination, my mind's eye. I'd recently been on a mythic context retreat at Pamaloka, where we were encouraged to explore symbols or images that we connected with. So I decided, well, this mindfulness of breathing is a bit dull. I'm going to put it down. I'm going to explore this treasure chest, see what's going on there. Yeah, and as soon as I decided to do that, I became aware of something, a presence that seemed much bigger, much larger, quite scary, actually quite dangerous, it felt like. And it felt like the presence of what I described as a dragon or a naga, saying, back off, basically, get away from the treasure. You're not ready for the treasure. Keep away from the treasure. And, so it was a very strong experience that I won't try and kind of put into, explain away. But overnight the first thing I did was go back to the mindfulness of breathing. I thought, well, maybe the mindfulness of breathing isn't so dull after all. Maybe I'll go back to that. But immediately overnight I became fascinated by nagas and dragons where I hadn't been before. And I thought, well, what is this symbol of the naga and the dragon? What does it mean? What's it saying to me? What are my depths trying to communicate to me? Why is there such symbolism around nagas and dragons in Buddhism? I just became really interested overnight. I just wanted to kind of soak up as much information as I could about nagas and dragons overnight. So what I want to do in this talk is just to share some of the lessons I've discovered about nagas and dragons, and particularly useful lessons if we're wanting to become a warrior on the spiritual life. Yeah. So I want to make it a practical talk. So I want to talk about what to do if you meet a dragon, what to do if you encounter a dragon. And where do dragons live? We're going to explore where do dragons live? Where do they abide? Where's their lair? What kind of weapons would you need if you encounter a dragon in the spiritual life? And what is the treasure? What treasure can you expect to win if you encounter a dragon? So a practical talk. And who better to learn from than the ultimate warrior? The warrior of peace. that tickle you. the Buddha. The Buddha Shakyamuni. Yeah, the Buddha Shakyamuni. The Buddha was from a warrior caste in India. I think it's called the Kshatriya caste. So his clan was a warrior clan. So the Buddha's kinship was that of a warrior. He was a warrior, but he became very different to his predecessors. He became, as we've heard, a warrior of peace. And the Buddha did have lots of dealings with nagas and dragons. So I want to read a sutta. And it's a sutta of an encounter with a troublesome naga. The Buddha encounters a troublesome naga. And it's a reading from the Vinaya Pitaka, it's called in the Pali Canon, the Mahavagga section. And I'm going to read it from Bhikkhu Nyanamoli's translation in the life of the Buddha. So thus have I heard. The Blessed One journeyed on by stages, till he at length arrived at Uruvela. Now at that time, three matted hair ascetics were living at Uruvela, called Kashyapa of Uruvela, Kashyapa of the river, and Kashyapa of Gaya. Kashyapa of Uruvela was the leader and principal of 500 matted hair ascetics, Kashyapa of the river of 300, and Kashyapa of Gaya of 200. The Blessed One went to the hermitage of Kashyapa of Uruvela, and he said, Kashyapa, if you have no objection, I should like to spend one night in your fire chamber. I have no objection, great monk, but there is a savage royal naga serpent there. He has supernormal powers, he is venomous, fearfully poisonous, and capable of killing you. So the Buddha asked a second time and a third time, and he received the same reply. And then the Buddha said, well, perhaps he will not destroy me. Grant me the fire chamber, Kashyapa. Then stay there as long as you like, great monk. So the Blessed One went into the fire chamber. He spread out a rush mat and sat down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness in front of him. When the naga saw the Blessed One come in, he was angry. He produced smoke. And then the Blessed One thought, suppose I counter his fire by fire, without injuring his outer skin or inner skin. He did so, and he produced smoke. Then the naga, no longer restraining his fury, produced flames. The Blessed One entered upon the fire element and produced flames too. The fire chamber seemed to burn and blaze and glow with their flames. The matted hair ascetics gathered round and they said, "The great monk who is so beautiful is being destroyed by the Naga." When the night was over and the Blessed One had countered the Naga's fire by fire without injuring him, he put him into his bowl and he showed him to Uruvela Kashyapa. "This is your Naga, Kashyapa. His fire has been countered by fire." Yeah, so it's an encounter between the Buddha and the Naga, which I want to explore, I want to unpack with you. And it was about 3 years ago now, I was lucky enough to go and spend an hour with Sangharakshita. Something you can do is go and write and ask his secretary to spend time with him. So I spent an hour with Sangharakshita about 3 years ago. And not surprisingly, one of the topics I wanted to talk about was Nagas and dragons. And I asked Sangharakshita about this sutta and what he thought about this sutta. And I was struck by what he said. He said it's important not to try and rationalise and explain away the sutta with our rational mind and say, well, it's probably some monks in a hut and they were having a fire and it looked a bit like there might have been a dragon, so that's where the story came from. He said it's important not to try and explain away the sutta rationally in that way. So I decided to try and take a different approach, a more imaginative approach to the sutta. And I've come up with a Bodhinaga commentary, my own commentary on what kind of how I interpret the sutta. So you may disagree with me, and that's fine, but this is kind of my take on what this sutta speaks to me, what it says to me. And the Buddha taught in many different ways. He encountered lots of different people, and he taught in lots of different ways to speak to the different people and to move and touch the different people, and also the different parts of the people he encountered, the kind of rational mind. And also he spoke to the depths using metaphor and myth and images and poetry. And an example of this, I think this is an example of that way of teaching, the Buddha using metaphor to describe an inner experience. And there's another striking example of that with the Buddha's enlightenment. So if you take the facts of the Buddha's enlightenment quite literally, well, basically you've got a scruffy looking guy, walks up to a tree, he sits down under the tree for quite a few days, he gets up again, looks at the tree, and then he bows to the tree and then he walks off. And they're the kind of outer facts of the Buddha's enlightenment. And not very inspiring, not very exciting. But the Buddhist tradition, the suttas tell a very different tale. They tell a very vivid inner story of the Buddha's tensions and conflicts, the resolutions, great surging up of energies. And they talk of attacks of mythical beings on the Buddha and the Buddha's encounter with these mythical beings. So the suttas use kind of this type of story to evoke an inner experience, what's going on inside the mind, the consciousness of a practitioner. And I think this is another example with this sutta. It's trying to describe an inner experience of the spiritual warrior. So, yeah, and I think it's a sutta, which I'll explore further later, but it's a sutta mainly about meditation, what takes place in meditation. I'll explain that. I'll draw that out a bit further later on. So the first question on our dragon hunt, the first question to address is, where does the dragon live? What is the fire chamber? What is the fire chamber? What does this convey? What does it symbolise, the fire chamber? Well, the element of fire is associated with transformation. It's also associated with the burning heat of strong emotions, passions and strong emotions. We've got the Buddha Amitabha, who's the picture on the wall behind you there. And the Buddha Amitabha is associated with the element of fire and transformation and deep meditation. And I've put these peacock feathers at the side of the shrine because the peacock is associated with Amitabha. And the peacock is said to feed on poisonous snakes and turn them into its beautiful plumage. So the peacock is a symbol of Amitabha and a symbol of transformation and meditation and fire. So the element of fire, what is the fire chamber? The element of fire is associated with transformation and the heat of strong emotion. For me, this fire chamber represents the chamber of strong emotion, the chamber of the heart, what we've heard in the Dhammapada, the cave of the heart, the fire chamber of the heart, the chamber of strong emotion. And Kashyapa of Uruvela and his ascetics are afraid to go into the fire chamber. They don't want to go into it. So I don't know what it's like for guys in other parts of the world and other countries, but in the north of England, in the north of the UK, we don't go into the fire chamber. We don't go into the chamber of strong emotion. And what I learned from my dad when I grew up was, don't go into the fire chamber, son. Men don't have emotions. We don't have strong emotions. Well, that's not true. We do have emotions, but we pretend we don't have them. And in fact, you could say we might be scared. We might even be scared of strong emotions, some of us. That was certainly the environment I grew up in and the conditioning I received in the north of England. So what happens? What happens if you're scared to go into the fire chamber, if you don't enter the fire chamber, if you're scared of strong emotions? just bear with me. I'll be speaking largely about the emotion of anger in this talk, but this what I'm going to say applies equally to other emotions. So, you know, there could be other emotions that are difficult for you, such as fear, sadness, love even. But I'm going to be speaking, and it applies equally, but I'm going to be speaking about anger in this talk. So what happens if you don't engage your emotions? If you don't engage the energy behind your emotions, if you're too scared to go into the fire chamber, what happens? Well, in The Religion of Art, a talk in a book called The Religion of Art, Sangharakshita likens our emotions to Cinderella. And he says this: if Cinderella isn't allowed to go to the ball, she will not stay quietly at home doing the dishes. Probably she'll set the home on fire instead. So if we don't engage our emotions, they cause trouble. They shout louder until they get our attention. And if we continue to ignore them, they become more and more fierce. They appear to us more and more monstrous. They become destructive. And they appear to us like monsters and demons. And we're even more afraid to go into the fire chamber to encounter them. But when we start to meditate, we begin to develop awareness. Our awareness starts to go below the surface levels and drops deeper down. And we begin to encounter emotions that appear difficult to us, maybe even monstrous to us. We experience emotions we think we're not supposed to have, we're not supposed to experience. So it could be emotions like hatred of other people, jealousy, cruelty, forbidden sexual desire, rage that we're not supposed to experience. We may encounter all these emotions that we're not supposed to have. And it might feel a bit like we've gone backwards in our practice. You know, we've started meditating and all of a sudden we're experiencing all of these emotions. Actually, we haven't gone backwards. We've become more aware of what's going on. We've become more aware of our emotional inner world. So when that happens, we can feel threatened. Our idea of who we are feels threatened. Our identity becomes threatened. It can be very frightening. To have that happen, to just have your idea, who you thought you were, that is threatened. So what we want to do is get rid of that experience. We want to push away that experience. And what we can do is we can end up with a dragon in the fire chamber and the door to the fire chamber firmly shut, firmly locked, and a no entry sign on the door. Don't go in the fire chamber. And this is what's happened as the Buddha arrives in this myth, in this story, in this sutta. Kashyapa and his ascetic followers won't go in the fire chamber. The fire chamber is locked and there's a monstrous Naga, fire-breathing Naga inside. And in our emotional life, there's two ways, there's kind of two different ways I think this can manifest. And the first one might be, maybe before we've started meditating, or as we first come to meditation, denial, where we're not really aware at all of our emotions, these emotions that are going on. And, what anger, what fire chamber, what anger? I don't experience emotions. I'm a nice Buddhist, I'm a nice person, I don't experience anger. So there's kind of like an unawareness, a denial almost, of what's there. And along with that can come a sense of shame or guilt. There's something, we're just dimly aware there's something we're uncomfortable about, but we don't know what it is. So we can experience guilt, shame, self-hatred even, but not really be clear about what's going on for us emotionally. But meanwhile, the dragon's attacking. The dragon can be, the anger, the emotion is driving us without us realizing us, without us being aware of it, with our actions and our speech. And then secondly, when we can't deny these emotions exist, when we encounter these emotions and we're not comfortable with them, we're not happy, another thing we can do is just push them away and repress them, just push them away and push them back in the fire chamber and just think, well, this is not the kind of person I want to be. I'm not that kind of person. I want to be a nice Buddhist. So that stuff can just stay in the fire chamber and I'm going to carry on with making myself a nice Buddhist. So they're the kind of two ways that we can just not deal, not engage with our emotions. And yeah, and this approach can also be characterized by quite a willful approach in meditation to avoid experiencing ourselves. And what we can do is kind of force ourselves into kind of quite a concentrated state, but with just a narrow part of ourselves, just a, you know, a small fraction of our energies. We can kind of force ourselves into a concentrated state, maybe using techniques, and we can just avoid actually and leave untouched all the kind of great depths of our emotions. We can just leave them untouched and they can be untransformed. And there's a term for this which has been coined, which is spiritual bypassing, where we can kind of bypass all of our emotional stuff that we need to engage with and just, you know, just try and force ourselves into a concentrated state. I mean, for me, there's an image. I'm quite good at this, because if I'm speaking as I know a lot about emotions, but actually I don't like emotions and I don't like experiencing them very much. I'm getting better at it, but I don't like them. And what I found I can do quite well in meditation is a bit like a ninja. If I see a negative emotion or an unskillful emotion, I can just do a karate chop. Oh, there's ill will, I don't want that. Or there's craving, I don't want that. And so I'm kind of, as soon as the emotion arises in meditation, I'm kind of forcing it back down and kind of pushing it away. In a way, I'm mindful of it, I'm aware of it, but I'm using that to push it away rather than to engage with it. And Sangha Rakshita calls this type of meditation approach, where you can get concentrated without engaging much with what's going on, as a forcible disruption of one part of the psyche from the rest. And there's a seminar that I looked at about, because Sangha Rakshita talks a lot about working with emotions in this particular seminar. It's called The Chapter of the Snake, and it's a chapter from the Sutta Nipata in the Pali Canon. It's a seminar called The Chapter of the Snake. And in this, Sangha Rakshita says, "The ordinary approach of the spiritual life is that you bash your passions on the head. You sort of knock them half unconscious. You knock yourself half unconscious too in the process. Then you can't do very much. So if you don't go into the fire chamber, you end up cutting off all the energy that's bound up in these strong emotions. Most of our energy gets used up, kind of tied up in a conflict, trying to kind of push away the emotions. And all our energy gets bound up with this. And we can't do very much. We don't have very much energy available." And this was a state I was in when I first came to the Dharma. Basically, not really feeling anything very strongly. Certainly, I had the view I've never really been angry that much. I'm not kind of an angry person. I was kind of, my emotions were blocked and I was cut off from kind of deeper intuition, a deeper instinct, a deeper sense of wisdom. I was cut off from all the energy that comes with these emotions. And Dharma Sharling talked about kind of what we care for, really caring about things, caring about values, stepping up for values, speaking out for them. And in a way, I was cut off really from what I didn't really know what I cared about. I didn't really know what I valued. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I had a sense that there might be part of me somewhere that knew, but I just felt cut off from it. And I can really resonate with what Dharma Sharling said about being a passenger in your own life. And that came up for me quite strongly as an image. I was doing a Wolf at the Door writing workshop, a weekend writing workshop in Sheffield. And one evening I just went home in floods of tears, just really unexpectedly from someone who doesn't experience a lot of emotion at the time. It just kind of unlocked all this emotion. And I just had this sense, I'm a passenger in my life. I don't know. I'm not in control. I'm not in the driving seat. I'm not in control of my life. And what was happening, I was just cut off from a deeper part of me that knew what I cared about, knew what I wanted to do with my life. So that had to change. That needed to change. So what does the Buddha do? What does the Buddha do in this situation, going back to the sutta? Kashyapa's there. There's a big dragon in the fire chamber. It's locked. He's afraid to go in. What does the Buddha do? Well, the Buddha goes into the fire chamber. He goes straight into the fire chamber and he sits down and, and he establishes mindfulness. So I'm imagining that the fire chamber, probably about the size of this shrine room, filled with a naga, terrifying naga serpent. Just, you know, the whole of the shrine room filled with a naga serpent. And the Buddha just goes in, comes into the shrine room door, gets some grass and sits himself down. His back erect, his body erect, and establishes mindfulness. He goes into a deep meditation. And it's great actually having Arlauca's statue here, because it's just gives me a real kind of vivid sense of what that might have been like. So yeah, so the Buddha, he sits down, he gets some mat, some grass, makes himself a meditation mat, and he establishes himself in mindfulness. So the next thing I want to talk about is a little bit about mindfulness and how we work with mindfulness and meditation, quite briefly. So there's three aspects to mindfulness. And the first aspect is called sati. And you might have heard of the Satipatthana. So there's an aspect of mindfulness which is called sati. And that's where we're, you know, what a lot of people understand as mindfulness, where we're present in the moment, where we're with our experience, we're experiencing what's happening. We're aware of what's happening. We're occupying the present, it's sometimes called. So that's the aspect of mindfulness which is called sati. And a lot of the time people just think that's all there is to mindfulness. So people talk about being in the moment. And I wonder whether kind of sometimes in secular mindfulness or in other mindfulness, when people talk about mindfulness, this is all they mean is sati. But that's not enough. If being aware of what's happening isn't enough, because I could be aware that I'm shouting at my next door neighbour. I could be aware I'm kicking the cat, or I'm about to punch a man in the face. And it's not enough to be aware of that, actually. We need something else with our mindfulness. And there's a second aspect of mindfulness called sampajana. And that's sometimes translated as mindfulness of purpose. You could also describe it as being mindful of what you're about, what you care for, what you value, what your ideals are. And there's a Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara, holds a jewel to his heart. And it's a jewel of the bodhicitta, which is the desire to want, the desire for enlightenment for all beings. But it's very significant that Avalokiteshvara holds that to his heart. And for me, that's a symbol of sampajana. We hold to our heart what's most important to us. We keep our values to our heart. We stay mindful of our purpose, what's important to us. And if we do that, if we've got those two elements, if we're in the present and aware of what's happening, and we're also aware of what's important to us, well, a third aspect of mindfulness comes into play, which is called appamada, or appamada. And this was what's on the Buddha's deathbed. The Buddha's dying words were, "With mindfulness, strive on." And the word he used was appamada. It's this aspect of mindfulness. And this is what's sometimes called an ethical vigilance, an ethical awareness. It's the part of us, it's the kind of voice that might kick in, the alarm bell that goes off and says, don't kick the cat, don't punch the man in the face. That's not an ethical thing. That's not in line with your values. So appamada is the ethical vigilance, the part of us, part of mindfulness that helps us to operate in the gap, not to act unskillfully. So we have all of these three going on. So when it says in the sutta the Buddha established mindfulness, there's these three aspects going on. And I like to use an analogy for these three aspects of a bit like a sat-nav in our car, if you've got a car or a sat-nav, or you might have encountered somebody who has got one. And to begin with, we put in the destination where we want to go to, which I liken to sampajana. It's kind of keeping in mind where we want to go to, where we want to be, who we want to become, our destination. But then whilst we're driving, we're aware of what's going on. We're aware of the road we're on, the cars around us, the speed we're travelling at, which is sati. That's the aspect of just being aware of what's happening right now in the present. But then also the sat-nav, if we take a wrong turn or say, turn around at the next junction, turn around, go back the way you've come from. You're going in the wrong direction. Well, it doesn't go to as much length as that, but it's the voice that says, turn around, go back, don't kick the cat. So, we've got these three aspects of mindfulness at play, interacting with each other. So the Buddha enters the fire chamber, and the Naga is angry. The Naga is uncomfortable, he's angry. So the Naga breathes out smoke and fills the fire chamber with smoke. So for me, this speaks to me of what can happen sometimes in my meditation, where I might just be on the edge of something, and my mind just fills up with it's the first line of attack, of defense of the Naga. Actually, it's the first line of defense, and it's the kind of smoky stories that fill the mind and say, "Well, you can't meditate. Don't bother meditating." It's kind of this for me. This is a hindrance of doubt and anxiety. It says, "Well, meditation doesn't work. You don't know what you're doing this for. This isn't going to work. This doesn't work. What are you bothering meditating for?" And it's the first line of defense of the Naga. It's the stories that fill our mind. And there's a word for this in Buddhism called prapancha. It's the kind of stories that we inhabit, that we live in. And the Buddha has established mindfulness. If we've established mindfulness in our meditation practice, well, what kicks in is the vigilance, the apramada that says, well, this isn't true. You know, I know meditation works. You know, I've experienced the fruits of meditation. I've seen other people and how meditation's transformed them. So I know this isn't true. So we can use applied thinking just to counter that. So the Buddha counters the smoke of the Naga with his own smoke. He fills the shrine room or the fire chamber with purifying smoke of applied thinking, clear thinking, which comes from Sampajana, from his confidence and trust in the values, the practices. So yeah, so the Naga breathes out smoke and the Buddha counters with his own smoke. And if we do that, that enables us to just drop below the stories, drop below the surface level, this kind of surface level, the surface chatter, drop below the stories into a deeper experience. And usually that happens in the body. That takes place in the body, mindfulness of the body. So it's really crucial in our meditation practice to establish mindfulness of the body. And for me, the body is like the vessel that contains our emotional experience. If we can drop deeper, drop below the surface level of those stories and into inhabit our bodies, we can really experience strong emotion in our meditation practice. It's like we're dropping a level deeper, deeper into our consciousness, deeper into our being. And sometimes in a meditation practice, you might experience, it's like your whole body becomes suffused with energy, just with emotion. And your body just might become suffused with strong emotion. And then for me, that's the part of the story where we feel the real heat of the dragon, we feel the real heat of the emotion, where the Naga breathes flames. You know, we've gone below the first line of defense, trying to get us to back away from the emotion, and we feel the flames, the heat of the strong emotion. So that can be an uncomfortable experience. That can be a frightening, scary experience if we start to encounter strong emotions we might not want, we don't think are acceptable, we should have, but you know, we really strongly experience them in meditation or outside of meditation. Well, that can be a scary experience. And as a warrior on the spiritual path, we've got two choices, actually, as Dharma Sharlin talked about. We can either shrink away from that, back away from that, or we can step up, step into that. We can be courageous and decide to sit with the Naga. We can kind of just sit and feel, experience fully whatever's going on. Whatever's happening, we can turn towards it and we can fully experience it and just allow it to happen, to turn towards it. So, yeah. In that same seminar, the chapter of the snake, Sangha actually tells a story about a Victorian thinker. I think in the kind of early part of the last century, there's a guy called Herbert Spencer. And Herbert Spencer had a woolen suit. Yeah, whenever Herbert Spencer came down the stairs for breakfast with his family, if he was wearing this particular woolen suit, the rest of his family would know to give Herbert Spencer a wide berth because he was in a bad mood, he was angry. And they needed just to give him some space. And Sangha actually suggests in the seminar, well, maybe we need something like Herbert Spencer's woolen suit. We need some, you know, we need a signal to tell the people we're living with, actually, I'm experiencing quite a lot of anger. I'm not in a good state, and I need some space. Because we need to be able to experience whatever's happening. We need to be able to be with whatever's happening. And sometimes we just need space. We need to be allowed to experience what's happening. Soon after, maybe a year or two, this is year two fast forwarding from my encounter with the dragon in the shrine room, I started to, and I'd had this sense of myself being a nice Buddhist, really, not somebody who gets angry very much. Out of the blue, really, I started to experience lots of anger, lots and lots of anger, almost kind of waves of anger would just kind of come up for me, sometimes in meditation, often in meditation, and often outside of meditation as well. And it was often unrelated to what was happening right now. So there'd be an incident, maybe quite a small incident might kind of spark it off, but I'd just get really, really angry, just kind of much, much more angry than it was warranted, than it was kind of... it was sensible to be angry. It just seemed to be completely unrelated to what was happening. And what I realised is actually it was almost like that kind of big reservoir of emotion that I've not experienced in my life. And I just needed to process it. I needed to sit with it. I needed to experience it, encounter it, to feel it. And my wife Lucy was very helpful with this. I remember one time going for a walk with her in Sheffield Botanical Gardens and just realising I was just really, really angry. And I was also realised, well, it was nothing to do with her. She hadn't done anything. She hadn't done anything wrong. And I was still really, really angry. And I just had to explain to her, well, I'm really sorry. I'm just really angry. And it's nothing to do with you. You haven't done anything. But I need to experience this. I need to kind of, I can't do anything other than be angry. And she was very patient with me, actually, and just gave me space, just allowed me to experience what was going on. Which was, you know, I'm very grateful to her for having done that. So Sangha Baxter says in that seminar, wrath, anger and fury may arise in the mind. And this is natural. Sometimes situations do occur, or you have experiences that make you angry, even furious. In a sense, you can't help that. What you can help is that you don't give way to it. You don't let it rage unrestrained. This does not mean pretending you don't feel angry. It's not, as it were, alienating yourself from the feeling of being angry. It's saying to yourself, yes, I am very angry. Rightly or wrongly, this is what I feel. This is what I experience. But it would not be skillful of me to give outward expression to this. So, yeah, the anger, whatever there, whether it's anger or another strong emotion, we experience it fully. We fully experience it. And, so the flames of the Naga are fully felt by the Buddha. They're fully felt by the Buddha in the fire chamber. The Buddha sits with them. But you'll notice in the story, the flames don't spill out from the fire chamber. They stay contained within the fire chamber. So the other ascetics are standing around watching what's going on, but the flames don't spill out and harm them. It's all contained within the fire chamber. So in the same way, we need to be able to fully feel our emotion, fully feel what's happening and contain it, be able to contain it so it doesn't spill out onto the people around us in our behaviour, in our speech. So that's where Appamada comes in, this sense of ethical vigilance that stops us from kicking the cat or punching the man in the face, whatever it is we feel like we want to do. You know, we can fully experience it, but we don't act it out. And in meditation, well, there's not a danger in meditation that we're going to act out. We're not going to physically harm somebody in meditation. So we can fully experience what's going to go on, what's happening in our meditation. But what the danger is that we can get caught up in the stories, the kind of smoke of the Naga. And it might be stories like, well, how dare they? How dare they do that? Why did they do that? And it can really fuel the anger. And in a way, we're not fully experiencing the anger. We're just kind of getting carried away with it. So the danger in meditation is that we get caught up in the stories. And the way to do that is to unhook from the stories and to drop deeper into our experience with mindfulness of the body, to really feel the experience in our body. So it's like our body is the vessel that holds, that can contain the emotion. So, yeah, there's two caveats, there's two dangers to what I'm speaking about, so I need to kind of clarify those. Firstly, if you're somebody who's already in touch with your anger, and you don't have a problem usually experiencing or expressing your anger, I'm not giving you a license, I'm not saying, don't use this as an excuse to say, well, Bodhinaga says I can be angry, so it's okay for me to shout at you because Bodhinaga says so. So it's a first caveat. It's basically, if you're already in touch with your anger and it's not an issue for you, maybe there's other emotions that you're scared of. There might be other emotions that you're not experiencing. It could be vulnerability. It could be sadness, grief. There could be other strong emotions that they're the ones you need to work with. And secondly, the second danger is, well, it's possible to get a bit self-obsessed with our inner world, you know, just to be kind of consumed by whatever's going on, and kind of just get lost in our inner world and our emotions, and kind of forget about other people, forget about reaching out to other people and interacting with other people. So that's another danger. We can kind of get so caught up, so obsessed, consumed by our inner world and our emotions that we just lose sight of the people around us. So there's two dangers around really fully experiencing the heat of the strong emotions, the flames of the Naga. So going back to the sutta, back to the story. Yeah, so the Buddha's entered the fire chamber. He's gone courageously where Kashyapa won't go. He's experienced the smoke of the Naga and countered it with his own smoke. And then the Nagas breathed flames, and the Buddha sat and experienced the flames of the Naga. So what the Buddha does next is he counters with his own fire. The Buddha counters with his own fire, his own flames. But it's interesting to note the Buddha doesn't want to harm the dragon, harm the Naga. He says, supposing I can produce fire without harming the skin of the dragon. And so the Buddha doesn't fight the dragon. So you get Christian stories, often Christian stories of encounters with dragons. And it's often the knight, like St. George, slaying the dragon, killing the dragon. But if we kill the dragon, we don't get the treasure. And I'll tell you, I'm not going to tell you what the treasure is yet. That's to come later. But if we kill the dragon, we don't get the treasure. So the Buddha doesn't try to fight the dragon. He doesn't try to fight the experience. He produces flames of his own. So these are flames of transformation, flames of compassion, and flames of metta. So the Buddha counters whatever's going on with the dragon, whatever's going on with the strong emotion, with compassion and metta. The Buddha's able to hold whatever's there, to contain it, envelop it with flames of metta and compassion. So what if we push away, if we repress and push away our emotions, well, that hostility gets mirrored back to us. They appear more and more hostile to us. They appear more and more monstrous, more and more terrifying. So we, in a way, we don't want to be pushing away what's there, but we can turn towards it with compassion and kindness and metta. The sixth verse of the Dhammapada, which we've been hearing from the mind section, or the first section, the sixth verse says, hatreds cannot be conquered by hatred. They can only be conquered by love. This is the eternal law. So to conquer hatred that we experience, we can only conquer it with love, with metta, with compassion. And I've got two anecdotes that hopefully will help to illustrate this. And the first one is a story of a horse tamer from Venezuela. And this was a story I heard on our ordination course. There's a Venezuelan guy called Padmashalin was there, another great Shalin, Padmashalin was there. And he told the story of his grandfather who used to tame wild horses or work with wild horses in Venezuela. And the way he worked with them was through kindness and love. He learned that by treating the wild horses with kindness and real love, he didn't need to use any restraint or any force, that the horses would just develop a real deep bond, a real deep trust with Padmashalin's grandfather, and they'd always return to him. They might disappear for a day or two, but they'd always come back. So he was able to develop this real deep affinity, a deep trust with this wild horse without needing to use any restraint or any force, just by responding with love and kindness and compassion to the horse. And then the second story is of my cat. I've got a cat called Missy Cat. We've actually got two cats at home, and we rescued them from a cat shelter in Sheffield. And in a sense, they were kind of quite wild, feral cats. And at the cat shelter, they told us, well, one of them in particular, one of them is quite kind of friendly, but a bit scared. The other one was just vicious, just really violent feral cat. And she was a female we called a Missy Cat. She was basically, if you made any move towards Missy Cat, she was just really frightened, she'd hiss. And Lucy, my wife, just got scars down her arms from when we tried to take her to the vet one time, where she just went berserk and just kind of lashing out, just really kind of going for Lucy with her claws. And the cat shelter told us when we took them on, well, they come together, they come as a pair, these two, the brother and sister. If you take the kind of nice cat, you have to get the kind of wild, savage cat with us. And in a way, actually, that, and I've not put this in my talk, but that's a good metaphor for our mind, in a way. You want the nice bits, you get the kind of savage, wild bits as well. They come together, they come as a pair. And it was like this with our cats. And the cat shelter told us, or that Missy Cat would probably never become kind of tame, would never be able to stroke her or move towards her. She'd always probably be kind of quite wild and feral. But I just had a sense that the way to be with Missy was to just sit with her, actually, just to sit in the room with her and not to move, not to kind of try and stroke her, not to move towards her, but just to kind of sit in the same room as her. And I did this for quite a long time, probably for about a year. Not in one go, but just sort of, in different times. I'd just sit with Missy for about an hour and just not do anything really, just kind of let her sit on the other side of the room and kind of move around a bit, but not do too much. And after a year, she let me stroke her for the first time. She let me stroke her. And after about 3 or 4 years, she just became a completely different cat, actually. And she now has developed quite a deep, seems to have kind of quite a deep trust towards me. And she follows me around the house whenever I'm in the house. And at night time, she sleeps on top of my legs, which can be a bit infuriating, a bit troublesome, trying to get to sleep. And if I go for a pee in the night, she kind of gets up and follows me and comes back again. So she's completely transformed, just from me, in a way, just sitting in the same room as her, not trying to do anything, not trying to change her or move towards her, just by sitting with her. And for me, it's a really good metaphor of how we can work with our mind, actually, those aspects of our mind that appear troublesome to us. You know, in a way, we just need to sit with them with kindness, with metta. We just need to sit with whatever's there in our experience. And, you know, we need to earn the trust of it, you could say. So the Buddha counters the flames of the Naga with his own flames of metta and compassion. And he just stands his ground. He isn't afraid. He doesn't run out of the fire chamber. He just stays there. He stays there and produces his own flames of compassion and metta. And he waits. He just waits for as long as it takes in the fire chamber to win the respect of the Naga and to get the treasure. So the Buddha stays in the fire chamber all through the night until he emerges at the end of the night with the Naga in his begging bowl, which is quite a curious image, actually, the Naga in his begging bowl. I wonder what that might symbolise. I don't have an answer, but it's just quite curious. So he comes out, and the Naga is now this kind of small, tame Naga in the Buddha's begging bowl. And he says to Kashyapa, "Kashyapa, here is your Naga. I have countered his fire with fire." Yeah, so for me, part of the symbolism of this is the Buddha has the Naga at his command. The Naga is now in the begging bowl of the Buddha. And it's a symbol for all that energy which can be tied up in our anger, ill will and craving. It's available now at the fingertips of the Buddha. The Buddha has all of that energy available at his command. So again, in this same seminar, Sangharakshita says, "In a highly developed person, his energy, even in a sense his anger, is not pulled back. The energy is there and is available. It doesn't move until it is given the word. It is completely, as it were, obedient. For us, it's quite difficult to imagine having a powerful emotion, usually labelled as unskillful, and just having it there. It's available, and it isn't actually going out. If we can be in that state, all our energy is there. The potentiality of anger is there, but we don't become angry. Well, then that is very positive. Then we have lots of energy, and we're very alive." So when our emotions are flowing and unblocked, when we've turned the volume up on our emotional life, well then, and we're able to contain it, it doesn't spill out, well then we can feel strongly, we're able to feel strongly, we're able to care deeply, to care passionately about life. You know, when we've turned up the volume on our emotional life, we can care deeply and we can feel passionately, care deeply about life. We want to protect what's important. We want to, you know, in a way, nothing, in that state, nothing can stop us from practicing and from building Sangha, from serving the Dharma. That's a very powerful state to have. It's a state we need to step up as spiritual warriors, is to have that energy available. We need that energy available, you know, the energy of our emotional life. So I think one way that this has been expressed, having this energy available, starting to have this energy available, is that I'm beginning to speak out more in my life. It's something I never used to do. I used to always want to kind of hide away from conflict and just to kind of have anything for an easy life, really, not to want to rock the boat. But now it's becoming that I'm starting to want to protect what's important and wanting to speak out to protect what's important. Something else about working with energy, which I haven't got time to go into, but you might want to explore further, is another aspect of this is that we, as well as harnessing our energies and fully experiencing them, we need to refine our emotions, we need to refine our energies. And Sangharakshita talks a lot about this in both Religion of Art and Reimagining the Buddha. There's quite a lot of practical input about how to work to refine our energies, because we need to do that as well. Sometimes the energies we harness are quite coarse, wild energies, but we need to refine them. So you might, if you're interested, I'd recommend the Religion of Art and Reimagining the Buddha. Yeah, so we're nearing the end of our quest. So if we can sit with the Naga in meditation, if we can harness our deeper energies, and so the energies become available to protect what's highest, Well, then the treasure becomes available to us. Then the treasure of the dragons and the nagas becomes available to us. And so what is it? What is the treasure that is available to us, that becomes available to us when we tame the nagas and dragons? Well, the nagas and dragons are protectors of wisdom or insight. So in the Buddhist traditions, the nagas are protectors of insight, of seeing things very, very clearly, seeing things as they are. So a bit about that. Traditionally in the Buddhist spiral path, Sangharaksa is called the kind of the chains leading towards awakening, a spiral path. So each state leads to an ever more expansive state, and the fullness of that state leads to an even more expansive state. And there's a crucial state as we move towards awakening, which is called insight or stream entry. And sometimes we call it also spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. And it's crucial because then we see through the illusion of self, the illusion of a fixed self, and we enter the stream of the Dharma that carries us to awakening. So it's a very, very crucial stage in the development, you know, in the spiritual life. And the stage before that, the stage that leads to insight, is called samadhi. And samadhi is often translated as concentration, but I think the translation of concentration can be a bit misleading, or can lead to the spiritual bypassing I spoke about earlier. If we're trying to kind of forcibly get concentrated, it's not going to lead to insight. So in the Three Jewels, a book called The Three Jewels, Sangharaksa just says, well, samadhi translates as gathering together. It's a gathering together. And he says, the concentrated mind sees things as they are. But if the samadhi is not true samadhi, but a mere forcible fixation of attention, disrupting one part of the psyche from the rest, there will arise from it nothing but delusion. The perfect samadhi which leads to insight involves not the forcible fixation of the mind on an object, not merely the exercise of understanding or the will, but the transformation and integration of the total psyche in all its sublimest heights and most abysmal depths. So, yeah, if you can integrate and harness your energies and cultivate positive emotion, what follows is spiritual death and rebirth. If we can kind of harness enough of ourselves, gather enough of ourselves, that's the stage that leads to insight, to true wisdom. That's the treasure. That's the treasure of the nagas and the dragons. So Dharmashalin spoke about the fellowship from the Lord of the Rings on Monday. And there's a really... Yeah, a really crucial part of the story in the first film, the first book, where the fellowship goes deep down into the minds of Moria. The whole fellowship goes down into the depths, deep down into the depths. And through mischievousness of the hobbits, what happens is a great Balrog is awoken. A great demon of the depths is awoken. And the fellowship are in deep trouble. The only way that they can escape is through Gandalf. Gandalf has to stand up to the Balrog. He has to face the Balrog. And what happens actually through Gandalf facing the Balrog is the fellowship can escape and continue. But Gandalf is killed. Gandalf dies. Gandalf the Grey is killed through his encounter with the Balrog. But it's a happy ending, because in the next film he comes back as Gandalf the White. He's reborn. You know, through dying as Gandalf the Grey, he's enabled to be reborn as Gandalf the White, almost like a being with magical powers from a transcendental realm. And the old Gandalf has died, and a new, much more potent, magical Gandalf appears because of that. So, if we want the treasure is spiritual death or insight. And the dragon doesn't die, you die. That's what happens, is what dies is our old stories about ourselves. The kind of limiting stories, the ideas of who we think we are, they have to die for us to become who we really could be. Those stories have to die. So when we encounter bits of ourselves we don't want to encounter, or the story about who we are has to die, the old idea of who we were has to die for something new to emerge. It's like the snake shedding its skin for something much, much more glorious and colourful to emerge. Yeah. So, yeah. I'm going to read just to close a couple of verses. And the first one's from the Dharmapada. We've been hearing about the chapter of the mind in the section of the mind in morning meditation. And just as a part of that really struck me as being relevant to what what I've been talking about. And it's where he talks about the, well, the Buddha talks about the heart cavern, going into the heart cavern. Wandering far and wide on its own without form, the mind lies in the heart cavern within. To bring it under control is to be freed from the bonds of ignorance. So to tame in the mind in the heart cavern is what leads to insight. It's what frees us from ignorance. And yes, there's a link between, you know, a very big rich link between nagas and insight and wisdom, seeing things directly as they are. So that's why, in a way, you could ask the question, well, why bother? Why bother going into the fire chamber? And why bother facing the fearsome nagas and the nagas that breathe smoke and fire? Why bother doing it? And when it's so uncomfortable and can be so unpleasant sometimes, why bother doing that? Well, really, what we need to do that to be truly wise, to be in touch with the wisdom from the depths, we need to become a deeper person, a deeper being. We need to go into the fire chamber and harness all of that energy. So just a final quote from the Buddha, from the Udana. And there's a verse in the Udana, and it's it's where he talks about the taste of freedom, and Bhante talks, Sangharakshita talks about this in a famous lecture. And the Buddha says, just as the great ocean holds many precious jewels, so too this Dharma holds many treasures. Such treasures as the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, and the Four Satipatthanas. Just as the great ocean is the abode of whales, sea serpents, demons and monsters, whose lengths are hundreds of leagues. So too this Dharma is the abode of great beings, such beings as the stream entrant and the awakened ones. So yeah, so the it's interesting actually, in this sutta, this I said it's a sutta from the Pali Canon, the Mahavagga section of the Pali Canon. And I was just looking at it, and in the notes it says the Pali, for the term that's used for the Buddha in this sutta, is Manusa Naga. The dragon of men is what the Buddha's called in the sutta. And when he enters the fire chamber, it says the dragon of men faces the chief, the king of dragons. So the Buddha is referred to often in the Pali Canon actually as a naga, as a dragon. Sometimes he's called the Maha Naga, the great dragon, the great naga. So so now you know what to do. If you meet a dragon, now you know what to do. If you want to harness the energies of the dragon and win the great treasure of wisdom and spiritual death, well, you need to enter the fire chamber. You need to feel the full heat of the dragon. You need to go armed with the weapons of mindfulness, forbearance, compassion, and metta. And eventually we need to die the hero's death, the warrior's death, that gives us insight and wisdom. And so we can become who we really, truly could be.